This is episode number 56 with Steve Melhuis, founding partner of Wavemaker Impact. Welcome to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. My name is Andrew Senduk, a former banker turned tech entrepreneur. And in each episode, I interview the movers and shakers of the venture capital and investment space in Southeast Asia, with the only goal to help you discover how to raise more capital, build better companies, and to give you a better understanding of the people behind the biggest funds in the region. Thank you so much for spending time with me today. Now let's get started. All right, beautiful people, welcome to a new episode. Today is an amazing day because I'm sitting across Steve Melhuis. There should be some Dutch heritage there. I need to know more about that. But Steve, I mean, to me, I say this not often, but Steve to me is kind of like the dream journey of any entrepreneur building a business. And not an overnight success as well. I mean, you've been pounding and grinding it out for 10 plus years, 10, 15 years even. But then taking the company public, going IPO on NASDAQ, not just any type of exchange, but NASDAQ. So that's,
Well, NYSE, but yeah.
Yeah, NYSE. Well, to me, that's all like one category. So that's an amazing journey. But besides that, just want to highlight a few things about Steve. You've been CEO and investor of Komi Asia. It's back then a social network for comic fans and artists. CEO and founder of Business to Profit, which back then was a consulting practice. You're an advisor and investor to many different companies. Just naming a few, Lumitix, Hydroleap, Eglo Company, which also just raised their Series B, if I'm not mistaken, recently.
Correct.
You're the CEO and founder of Planet Rise, which is kind of like an impact investing fund. And you're the founding partner of Wavemaker Impact. And Wavemaker Impact is actually the first VC focused on climate tech and in Southeast Asia. So I'm really, really excited to have you on the show, Steve. Thank you so much for joining. How's everything in Singapore?
It's all good, Andrew. I mean, how am I supposed to kind of live up to all of that that intro?
That's a serious intro.
It's all going to be downhill from here. But I'm really excited to be on the show, and good to see you again.
Yeah, awesome, and, awesome.
Yeah, I look forward to having the chat.
Yeah, and before we start, I think a big shout out to Nick, because Nick actually introduced us together. Introduced us. So Nick from Velocity. A big shout out to you if you're listening. Steve, let's just kick it off, right? I mean, bringing your company IPO in a world where unicorns are, you know, are happening after 2-3 years after, you know, setting up the company, you've been doing it, quote unquote, the normal way, where, you know, you're actually 10, 15 years, you're just building, right? Just building a business. What does that do with you? Like bringing a company like IPO like that, having walked that journey, what is your thought about, you know, entrepreneurship in general and kind of like what's happening within the ecosystem right now where these startups, they scale so fast and, you know, they have these unicorn statuses after 2-3 years. Like, do you look at that with a kind of like a skeptic view or what is your take on that?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, I guess my own experience has been, as you said, you know, I the kind of overnight success in over 14 years, right? You know, the blood, sweat, and tears, and kind of, you know, dedication, and you know, ultimately a big team effort to build that business over that period of time. You know, and it was never about becoming a unicorn, right? It was about building a business which was kind of just addressing a real problem. And you know, that's what kept us awake at night. That's what kind of drove us through the whole process of building this business. And no, I mean, you know, if companies make it bigger and faster, then all you know, all credit to them, right? I think if you can build a business which is going to be long term, sustainable, you know, good unit economics, you know, can carry on growing, has got massive potential, then why shouldn't you be rewarded with a unicorn status?
Yeah.
You know, but the one thing I would say though is, you know, and it's one of the key things that conversations I have with the startups that I work with is, you know, do not get fixated on valuations at all.
Yeah,
ever.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant. You know, what's important is building a really, really long-term, sustainable, solid business, which is addressing a proper problem, right? Let's see what happens, right? So we're in the process now of softening evaluations on the back of what's happening in the public markets.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to drive private market valuations down, you know, and I guess, you know, in the context of our IPO, it's probably the worst possible time. But but no, seriously, I think, you know, there's going to be, there's for sure is going to be a bit of softening around valuations, right?
That's one thing that's for sure. But if you look at the, you raised like over what, $600-700 million, right? And I can imagine, like, even if you talk about, let's say, the young founders that we see now in the marketplace and that are raising big chunks of money. I read this interview with Adam Newman from WeWork, right? Where he said like, yeah, suddenly I was raising, you know, billions of dollars. And I thought like, okay, yeah, what I'm doing is correct, right? What I'm doing is correct. So how can young founders, how can they be, how do you call that? Like in Dutch, there's a saying for that, but in English, I would say like, how could you keep them on track? And just like you said, I can imagine if you're a founder and you've raised $700 million or $1 billion, it can get to your head as well, right? Which makes you not focus on the right fundamentals. Just like you said, the unit economics and just profitability, but you're like much more focused on, hey man, I'm building a $3 billion company. Like, you know, that, what does that do to people's mind?
Well, I think for me, it's going to start from the fundamentals, right? So one of the conversations I have quite regularly with the startups that I'm working with is, you know, how much money do you actually need? Yeah. And what's the minimum amount? Not the maximum. Mm. Don't forget about evaluations. Forget about raising a whole bunch, a big chunk of money, because ultimately, you know, that leads to potential risk in the future around down rounds. It leads to more dilution. You know, how much do you ultimately need? And also, who is the ideal investor? You know, don't let the tail wag the dog. If someone comes along, dangles a big amount of money and a high valuation in front of you, you know, it's all about, you know, building a sustainable business with core fundamentals, which basically means that, you know, you think about, okay, for the next 2 years, you know, how much do I need to build my business to the next stage of growth or next big milestones where I can justify a slight high valuation rather than today, just take money at a high valuation and then have the risk of a down round later on or a flat round later on. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Rather than raise 10 million, you know, and maybe try to raise 10 million and you fail to raise 10 million, rather raise 5 million and maybe oversubscribe by 10, 20, 30%. It sends out a far more positive message and supports the next fundraise, you know, whenever that might be in 2 years' time. So don't let the tail wag the dog. You know, I'm a firm believer that the founders and the company should dictate and decide what they want to do and how they want to grow their business. And don't let investors tell you what to do. I mean, all too often I hear conversations around investors telling companies to expand from one market to five markets as quickly as possible. Why? You know, I'd rather be an investor. I know, but it doesn't make it's a very short term, you know, approach. And I think, you know, I'd rather be an investor in a company which is, you know, strong player, dominant in that market, you know, has got breadth and depth and brand to leverage in that one market where you can kind of have a strong base to grow from to the next market, rather than, you know, thin across 10 markets, which therefore is a, you know, it's a more fragile company and you don't have any depth. Yeah. And therefore, you know, the risk is a lot higher. I just don't buy that.
Such a good point.
And I think, you know, my experience of building my business is, you know, at the time you might think you need to run, but actually in reality, you know, things don't change that fast. Right?
Yeah.
So if you take an extra year to get to a new market, but your business is going to be stronger as a result of that, then that's absolutely the right thing.
Yeah, I think that's such a crucial point, because at the end of the day, what you also said before, it's more like you choose your investors wisely, because you need to find that investor that says like, you know, if you spend one more year extra, but you make sure that the fundamentals of that one specific country or two countries is correct, then all good, right? But I think the majority of the investors would say like, you know, we need to scale. We need to be a much more presence, like, you know, expand to 5 countries or 10 countries. I think that is kind of like for entrepreneurs, it's much more a, you know, if you're in that position to kind of like negotiate or push back on that, right? And because you're the one running the business.
No, absolutely. I mean, so one of the things I talk to my companies about is very early on, before you talk to any investors, define who your ideal investor is. And what does the ideal investor mean? It's somebody who can help you with your top three challenges for the next 2 years.
Yeah.
You know, so let's say, for example, your business requires, you know, solid data science capability. Mm. If you can find an investor who has a portfolio or has a focus on expertise, for example, around data science, or you want to expand from Asia to US market. Mm. If you can find an investor who has deep, you know, expertise or portfolios or experience or network in the US, surely that's going to be a better investor for you, even at a lower valuation than someone who just happens to be throwing money at you in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
You know, so really thinking very clearly around what is the ideal. And you might not end up with that ideal investor at the end of the process, but at least start off with the intent that you find an investor who can kind of deliver that for you, and then keep the funnel as wide as possible.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, before talking to anyone, get everything in place, get clarity around your ideal investor before going out, and you know, hopefully through that process, you'll end up with a better outcome.
Yeah, no, it's such a good point. When we talk about, let's say, fundraising, right? So Property Guru raised $600-700 million. You know, here in what, five countries.
Yeah, five countries.
Yeah. It's being used by 50 million people. So there's like a lot of, there's like skill, right? There's like that the usage is like decent. It's like very decent, so to say.
Yeah.
When we make that bridge towards climate tech, which is an amazing idealistic goal and an amazing goal in general to, you know, to combine that capital with just saving the planet. Like, how do you balance the need for, you know, 50 million people using that software or using that tool versus the ROI that, you know, even the LPs who are backing, let's say, WaveMaker Impact or even like Planet Rise, like, how do you balance the two of, you know, the ROI that is also important, but at the same time, the time climate tech needs to get that critical mass?
Yeah, I think there is a false view, in my opinion, that climate tech or sustainability doesn't equal profit or doesn't equal scalable companies. And so if you think about the next 10 years, we need to reduce emissions by 50% globally, right? And today, the technology exists to achieve that. We don't need new technology. What we need is adoption of the technology, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So what stops this? It's business models, it's incentives, it's finance that's stopping this. So how do we adapt existing technology to address climate challenges?
Yeah.
So if you think about customers may say they care about sustainability, but they don't actually care about sustainability on the face. No one's really buying sustainability. But if you talk to a customer about, okay, if I can help you grow your revenue by 10%, if I can remove costs by 20%, would you be interested?
Yeah.
And clearly the answer is yes. So the whole thesis for WaveMaker, for example, WaveMaker Impact, was, look, Southeast Asia, it's 600 or 700 million people. The population is growing. The emissions per head is going from 5 tons per annum to 10 or 12 tons per annum. So you've got population growth, emissions growth, and a home to a third of the global carbon sinks disappearing. So we clearly need to do something, right? And then you say, okay, well, if investing climate tech to address this problem, that should help, right? But today, only 2% of climate tech investments going into Southeast Asia. But Southeast Asia is a growing problem and will bear the brunt, right? We're going to be wiping off 15 to 20% of a GDP in Southeast Asia because of climate change in the next 50 years.
Wow.
And we've got three of the biggest cities, Jakarta, Bangkok, Ho Chi Minh, sinking in the next 35 years.
Yeah.
And so, and then it's home, you know, the region here is home to a third of the global carbon sinks. But they're disappearing. So we have this double whammy: population growth, higher emissions per head, and by the way, the sink, which is capturing emissions, is disappearing. You're taking peatlands, for example, replacing it with agricultural, which is creating emissions. So we have a compounding issue here. And 2% of that climate tech investment is going into Southeast Asia. 70% is going to EVs. But actually, the emissions are elsewhere. They're in food, agri, land use, industrial processes, building, construction. So how do we address that? We address that by taking existing technology and adapting it to address a real business problem. So if I give you an example, right? So smallholder farmers, and there's 18 million of them in Southeast Asia. They are using diesel pumps for irrigation, so causing huge CO2 emissions, but actually diesel fuel is rising, and you know, and a big chunk of a farmer is earning $200 to $300 a month, of which 20 to 30% of their cost is diesel fuel.
Oh wow!
If you replace that diesel pump with a solar pump, that disappears. So immediately the farmer has got 20 to 30% or 40% or even more in some cases income in their pocket to feed their family.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't the farmer adopt that? It's not rocket science. It's basic technology. So it's a business model. Our challenge is, how do you go from one farmer to 100,000 farmers to a million farmers?
Yeah.
That's, so there's a scaling challenge here. But strong unit economics, 30 to 50% gross margins, growing from one farmer to 100 farmers to 500 farmers to 1,000 farmers very quickly. These businesses are venture companies. They are addressing real business problems, revenue and costs for a particular stakeholder. And the outcome of that is less emissions.
Yeah.
And that's how we think about it. You've got to address real business problems. Otherwise, people won't adopt the technology. And so technology should help with revenue or cost, essentially.
If it doesn't, forget it. Yeah, yeah. If we go back to that example, right, where let's say a smallholder farmer, instead of his diesel engine that he's using, he's going to use a solar. Who's going to finance the solar then? Is it still going? He still needs to buy that solar machine, or
you can buy it CapEx, or you can buy it, or you can lease it and finance it from the business that, for example, we're building.
Got a company called
Agros Solar.
Got it.
And then you start to say, well, okay, so you start to build trust with the farm.
Yeah.
And so the farmer goes, okay, I you're saving me immediately this money and more money in my pocket. And then you say, well, okay, well, if you irrigate better, do you do precision irrigation rather than just flooding your fields, then actually you'll get a better yield. Mm. But for us, we care about methane being produced, for example, but they care about yield. So then we do that. So the irrigation system can then have a precision irrigation system. Mm-hmm. And from there, you can say, oh, chemical fertilizer, the biofertilizer will save you 5% of your cost.
Yeah.
And rather than 30% of your crops being either, you know, degraded or wasted completely because they're not being stored properly, let's help you store it.
Yeah.
And so all of those touch points add up to less emissions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for the farmer, it's revenue, yield, cost, productivity.
It's funny, right? Because it's actually you're creating the same solution, you're offering the same solution, but I think, of course, for the farmer's perspective, that he just looks at what's important to him, right? I mean, that's the language that he speaks, right? So I think that's really beautiful. If you talk about reverting back to the 50 million users, 50 guys, 50 million users of Property Guru. What was, you know, looking back at, because scale is always a topic, right? Like, oh yeah, we need to scale. Yeah. We need to scale to the next level. What was kind of like pivotal, if you look back in these 15 years, to reach that critical mass of 50 million users of the platform? Was it just steady like every year, or have there been like any hacks that you'd say like, okay, if I again, you know, want to launch something or invest in something that needs to scale to 50 or 100 million, what would that be?
Well, I think there's the one thing I'd say is there's no silver bullet. But I think if I peel back the layers of the onion in terms of, you know, what were some of the critical success factors that helped contribute to that, I think there were a few things. So one is, you know, what's the problem we're trying to solve?
Yeah.
Right. And so it sounds really, really obvious, but being super fixated on what the customer problem is for a large group of customers. Mm. So in our case, who's paying us? It's the property developers, it's the property agents, it's the banks. So are they our customers, or is it the consumers who are customers?
Yeah.
In our case, we were very, very clear, right? The problem we're trying to solve is buying a property or renting a property or financing a property is a really super painful process. There's no information, there's no transparency, you know, there's no informational tools for me to be able to make a decision. And if I'm going to spend $500,000 or $1 million on a property and I don't have any information at my fingertips, that's an even more stressful process. I'm relying on an agent or a property developer or a family member to give me the best possible advice, which in many cases are not the best advice, or it's maybe the incentives are not aligned, right?
Yeah.
So what we set out to do and what we're still working on is, like, how do we help the consumer navigate this whole complex, stressful property process and equip them with the tools so they can make confident property decisions. And if you focus on that problem and you think, okay, look, there's a population of 700 million people, everybody needs a roof over their head, that's growing, it's urbanizing, people moving to cities, there's more properties being developed, so it's a growing problem. And so if we laser focus on solving the problems and learning what the problems are of the consumer, whether it's a tenant, whether it's a landlord, whether it's an owner, you know, how can we help them? And if we help them, we'll get the eyeballs, and if we get the eyeballs, we will get the paying customers on our side. And so, you know, we focus around it. So we innovated sometimes too much, but we innovated around that, we experimented around, you know, that we focused very much around solving that consumer challenge. And so, yeah, I mean, that's in a nutshell, that would be the key thing, right? Laser focus on the key problem you're trying to solve for a big enough bunch of customers. And the problem has to be big, right? Mm. And in our case, you know, there's 700 million population, you know, you've got $250 billion approximately of transactions happening every year across Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
You know, you've got people obsessed with real estate in some of these markets. Mm. And so it's a big enough problem. To solve. And so, but it's still very opaque and it's still very complex and hard and painful. So, you know, that's what keeps us awake at night.
I love that. It's kind of like, because sometimes when we talk about scale and growth, it's very, of course, metrics driven. But at the end of the day, it just comes back to this ideal customer avatar, like what is his or her problem, right? And just lasering into that problem and creating that solution for
exactly. And that, you take that and then translate that into what we're doing from a sustainability point of view, right?
Yeah.
You know, we're not. So of course we care about sustainability. We care about climate change. And that's that's what motivates us. We're creating, you know, these 100 by 100 companies, you know, 100 megaton, which is twice the size of Singapore's emissions, times 100 million revenue. Wow. Right. So these are, you know, each company we build and invest in has to have the potential at least to get towards those numbers. Right. Otherwise we will not do it. It has to be able to shift the needle. And the only way to do that and do it quickly in a venture grade way is focus on the business problem. So in the case of the farmer doesn't care about climate change. Of course, they're going to see the impact of climate change.
They
care about how can I get more money in the pocket
to
feed my family?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, a factory, they care about costs. You know, how do I get better margin in my factory? That's what they care about. How do I get more revenue? How do I get more customers? How do I reduce my costs? And so you've got to, you know, work and focus on the customers and really understand what their pain points are. So we, in Waymaker Impact, one of the things we do a lot is, you know, we interview 100 customers and we try to understand what are their pain points, nothing to do with sustainability, but you know, what keeps them awake at night? What are their priorities? What are their challenges? You know, what stresses them out?
Yeah.
And then we think, how do we address that, which then has a climate impact?
I love that. I love that. It just brings it back to the core. You're trying, or everyone is trying to sell a product or a service to someone, then we better know this someone very, very well, right? What keeps them awake at night? And I think, you know, in startups in general, I think this quote unquote focus groups or these type of interviews are not being done enough, which makes entrepreneurs like kind of like fly around. I assume this is going to be a good solution for my client base, right?
I mean, many entrepreneurs that I know, and include myself on that, you know, operate too much on gut sometimes.
And instinct.
But I think, you know, that kind of very structured process of you know, interviewing customers and really understanding what keeps them waking up is critical.
I love that. I love that. Steve, if we look at Planet Rise and we look at Wavemaker, Wavemaker Impact, what's kind of like the relationship between the two? Because those two are running. They're running. Both of them are running, right? I mean,
Well, I guess it's really more of a journey, right? So in 2018, when I decided to kind of step down from probably going to hire the CEO and hand it over, there's a transition process. And the whole driver for that was for me to spend more time with my family and spend time with my kids who I hadn't really seen them grow up in the first sort of three to four years of their life. And so I wanted to spend time with them, but which I did in 2018. But I also started thinking a bit about what do I do next?
Yeah.
And everywhere I looked, you know, I just felt like there's just this climate changing in my face, you know, $300 billion of extreme weather damage caused in 2018, you know, record temperatures in Siberia, you know, record wildfires in Australia and the west coast of the US, et cetera, right? And so the more I researched, the more shit scared I got about my kids' future and what the world's going to look like. And all the stuff I took for granted when I grew up in terms of swimming in oceans or skiing or walking through forests with nature, you know, it might not actually be there for them or their kids in the future. And that's a pretty sad and scary. So I felt like I could not look my kids in the eye if I did not do something about it. It plays a tiny part in this. And so I thought, what can I possibly do? And I guess what I know is building businesses and scaling companies. And I had been angel investing for, you know, 15 years or so. So I thought I start to do that. So that's what I started to do. So through Planet Rise, I started to invest in climate change companies, with climate tech companies and social impact companies. And the thesis for this is climate change is going to affect everybody, but particularly the bottom of the pyramid, you know, marginalized day workers, migrant workers, they're going to be the worst affected, right? And so that was the kind of thesis. So over 4 years, you know, we made, you know, 20 investments in companies which are doing this, but very quickly realized to really scale this in a big way, doing it in a me, myself, and I way through Planet Rise was not so scalable anymore. So how do you then actually have a bigger impact? And so I was having conversations with various people, including one where I'd made an investment in a company spun out of Engie, an Engie factory. Okay. And the two people who had built over 3 years, 10 ventures from scratch in the renewable energy and clean tech space, we're also starting to think a little bit about, well, what do they do next as well? And so we started the conversation, which then involved a couple of people from Wavemaker as well.
Got it.
And then over 12 months, we formed the thesis for Wavemaker Impact.
Got it. So if you talk now about investments, it's mostly through Wavemaker Impact.
It's a combination of both. Planet Rise is more established companies, a broader remit in terms of climate and also social impact.
Yeah.
WaveMaker Impact is you know, back to this point I made before around the climate tech investing at the moment in Southeast Asia is tiny, 2% of the total global.
Wow.
70% in EVs. And we, you know, what we don't need is another 100 EV companies in Southeast Asia. You know, because it's about 5 to 7% of where the emissions are.
Yeah.
But 50% is food, agri, land use.
Yeah.
You know, you got another 40% is industrial process of building construction. So what we need is entrepreneurs and money going into this space. And at the moment they're not.
Yeah.
So as they're not, then what do we do about it? Well, what we can do about it is actually build companies. So WaveMaker Impact's primary mode of operation is finding experienced entrepreneurs who've built one, two, or three companies already.
Yeah.
And work on one of 50 areas which we've identified, which we think we can shift the needle on, and build a company together.
Amazing.
And venture build.
Amazing.
Or super early stage and then supercharge.
Yeah.
Whereas Planet Rise is more established companies generally.
Got it.
You know, it's
kind
of pre-Series A to post-Series A, which are doing things maybe sometimes on a more global basis. But
amazing.
That's kind of difference.
Amazing. Especially, you know, the whole venture building part. I think that's just... that's super interesting, you know. And if you talk about changing the world, I mean, especially for next generation, those are great goals and great reasons to wake up every morning and do what you do, right?
I do want to make a point that, you know, these companies are venture grade companies we're building, right?
Yeah.
These are for profit, strong unit economics, fast growing companies.
Yeah.
And so you can have both. You can have your cake and eat it.
Yeah, I love that. Not too much though, not too much. But Steve, final two questions, right? I mean, looking into Property Guru's journey, and you know, you've built multiple companies in the past as well. Now in climate tech, would you say that you know, scaling a business, a non-climate tech business versus a climate tech business, is it exactly the same, or are there different drivers that really push the business to the next level?
I think the fundamentals in many cases are the same. As I mentioned, existing technology adopted and adapted. You know, so in the case of Property Guru, what is Property Guru? It's a software platform, right?
Yeah.
It's mobile app, software platform. Yeah. It's a bit of marketing. You know, I'm simplifying now, but in the same way, you know, we're just using existing technology and adapting and adopting it to the existing problem.
Yeah.
I'd say the one key difference in my experience over the last 4 years has been many of the founders I'm working with are so passionate around sustainability.
Mm.
Sometimes the business solution or value proposition gets lost in the sustainability piece because they're so passionate about it.
So
I spend a lot of time reframing, you know, talk about revenue, talk about
business.
That's one key thing.
Yeah.
The second key thing is in many cases, the climate tech companies have an element of hardware, you know, so it'd be like a SaaS platform, but maybe there's an IoT piece element to it, or maybe there's a solar panel, or, you know, it's again, not rocket science, but commodity products, but has a working capital requirement.
Yeah.
And this is one challenge, you know, so that they're, that w- in many cases, what slows the growth down is just as a little bit of working capital. You know, if you've got a customer and you've got to deploy a little bit of kit along with a software platform, there is a bit of working capital and there is a gap, you know, so equity financing, you know, anything from 25K to 250 million, no problem.
Mm.
But, you know, working capital, you know, there's no point raising $5 million to then use that to buy inventory, right?
I mean,
it's a very expensive cost of
capital.
Whereas, you know, getting some debt finance, and there is a gap in the market at the moment. You know, that if you want $1 or $2 million to maybe $10 million working capital to buy you 30 or 60 days between, you know, ordering and delivering of the kit and getting the cash in, there is a gap there. So that's probably the biggest difference, I think, is and that's one area which kind of I'm kind of keeping me awake at night, or keeping us awake at night, is how do we address that problem?
So
I think that's other than that, you know, I think there's not much difference between a climate tech company and a non-climate tech company.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I had the same discussion with, let's say, kind of like big data or like data scientists type of investors, right? Where they say our entrepreneurs that we invest in usually are like PhDs, they're like mathematicians and, you know, biomedical engineers. And oftentimes they spend too much in the theory, so to say, and we need to kind of like help them to bring it down, and you know, who are we actually selling this to? So that's amazing. Steve, a final question, right? Final question is this: I want you to imagine a day far away into the future. And on this day, I'm Googling Let's just assume that Google is still the search engine in this day in the future. I'm Googling Steve Melhuis, right? I'm Googling your name, and there's nothing I can find about Property Guru's IPO. There's nothing I can find about the amazing milestones that you've achieved professionally. No Facebook, no LinkedIn, nothing. The only thing that Google shows me are three bullet points. And these two bullet points, they represent Steve's life and your life lessons that you want to be remembered by. What would those three bullet points be?
Oh my God.
That, I get that reaction a lot, yeah.
Shit, that's a hard question, man. Yeah.
Well, you're already doing it, I think.
I think, you know, I guess hopefully, you know, passionate, hopefully generous, hopefully, you know, hardworking. Mm. I think those would be some of the key things, I guess, you know, try to play his bit to make the world a better place.
Mm. I love it. I love it. Steve, I want to salute you for, you know, for just being an inspiration to a lot of entrepreneurs out there, specifically in Southeast Asia. Your journey is, I think is for me a big inspiration. And even now what you're doing with you know, both Planet Rise and Wavemaker Impact, I'm really excited to where both of these investment vehicles, you know, will evolve into in the next, you know, years ahead and what type of change you're going to bring. And hopefully we can meet in Singapore or in Bali soon.
Sounds good, Andrew. And if any entrepreneurs or, you know, wannabe entrepreneurs are interested in doing things in the sustainability space or already doing things, my door is open. You know,
where could they find more? Where can they find more about you or Planet Rise?
The easiest thing is probably LinkedIn is probably the easiest thing. You know, LinkedIn, LinkedIn.com, Steve Mel, you know,
I think is
one way. We want more and more people to come in the space, whether it's investors, whether it's, you know, entrepreneurs or even corporate partners to come in and, you know, accelerate this adoption.
Because, you
know, we don't have time.
No, you're so right. And I think that's a good, good reminder for all of us, you know, in the crazy times we live in right now, I think the earth also has a timeline, and we should do anything we can to preserve it.
Steve, hey, the earth will be fine. It's just us.
Hey, okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
that is fine. It'll be fine. Don't worry.
Yeah. True.
It's
true.
It's just us. It's just humans. That's all.
All right, Steve. Thank you so much. Right. I'll see you soon. Thanks, and let's keep in touch. Bye bye.
Yeah, sounds good.
Bye bye. Thank you so much for listening to the Masters of Cashflow podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, then please make sure to subscribe over on Apple or Spotify. And I'd really appreciate it if you can leave a rating and review and let me know what your biggest takeaway is this episode. Thanks again, and I hope to see you in the next one.